Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. As rioters stormed the Capitol on January 6th, Washington, D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser lacked the authority to call in the National Guard. If she were a governor, she says, things would have been different.
Congress must immediately transfer command of the District of Columbia National Guard from the President of the United States and put it squarely under the command and control of the mayor of the District of Columbia.
The events of January 6th have given new urgency to an old fight, the push to make Washington, D.C. America's 51st state. The city of about 700,000 people is bigger than both Wyoming and Vermont. Yet the residents of the district have no voting members in Congress.
We are fighting for our freedom. We are fighting for the ability to pass laws that reflect our local values. We're fighting for control over our city.
That's Ty Hobson Powell. He's a pro-statehood organizer with the group 51 for 51, as in 51 votes in the Senate to make D.C., the 51st state. While the residents of D.C. have their own municipal government, Congress still reviews all laws passed by the city council, even its budget. That's why Hobson Powell says the fight for statehood is also about racial justice.
I mean, there is a symbolism in the fact that we have to have our majority black elected officials go and ask a majority white Congress for permission to pass laws that the citizens have already empowered them to enact.
President Biden backs the statehood movement. Last June, for the first time in history, the U.S. House of Representatives passed a statehood bill. And the Democrats are in control of Congress now, so advocates see this as their moment. But Republicans say not so fast. They oppose D.C. statehood because it would expand Democratic power in Congress. And they point to the Constitution, which says the national capital would not be part of a state nor treated as a state.
Washington is a city with all the characteristics of a city, not a state.
There's nothing these people won't do to change the face of the country, and we're tired of it.
And they want to codify all this by making the swamp itself, Washington, D.C., America's 51st state. With two more liberal senators, we cannot undo the damage they've done.
This hour on Point, new energy and the decades-long battle over D.C. statehood. We're going to start this hour with George Derek Musgrove. He's a history professor at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and co-author of the book Chocolate City, A History of Race and Democracy in the Nation's Capital. Derek, welcome to On Point. Thanks for joining us. It's great to have you.
Thank you for having me.
I really want to take advantage of your role as a historian, but I want to get into the history a little later and talk about now. There seems to be a lot aligning in favor of D.C. statehood. Democrats in control of Congress, a president who backs it. Is this as close as the statehood movement has come to the promised land?
Oh, absolutely. It's never come this close before. And I think that there's really three things that get us to this point. The first is that local activists are really well organized. That hasn't always been the case. But if you look in D.C., you know, we have a great grassroots organization in Neighbors United for D.C. statehood. We have a really impressive 501c3 in D.C. Vote. Eleanor Holmes Norton is relentless in her advocacy. And the mayor has really organized a very, you know, well-structured campaign that's gotten more than 80% of the population behind statehood and is trying to take advantage of Democratic control of the federal government to move this through. But I think there's two other things that really make this sort of the city's moment. The first is that the Democratic Party, the National Democratic Party, has come really for the first time in its history, in its majority, to believe that D.C. statehood is in its interest.
And I'll explain that, because, of course, when we think about statehood for D.C., we think primarily about the 700 residents within the District of Columbia. But you're saying there's a sort of political interest and motivation that extends well beyond that.
Absolutely. So, I mean, the Democratic Party is on record within its platforms going all the way back to 1940 is saying that it favors an expansion of the suffrage in the district. Remembering back in 1940, we had no vote at all in the district.
Yeah.
And it stayed sort of on message throughout that time. But you would always have large numbers of people within leadership who, you know, really couldn't articulate why it would benefit the party, would benefit a senator from, you know, Colorado or California. And today, I think Democrats see it differently. And what's really happened is the experience of the last roughly 20 years. In that time, they've seen two Republican presidents elected with a minority of the popular vote through the Electoral College. And they've seen that the party, the Republican Party, embrace disfranchisement and minority rule on the federal level, really is sort of a governing philosophy. So Republicans are gerrymandering districts back in the states to make sure that even though they have a minority of the population, they're going to be running certain southern states, in particular Midwestern states. That, you know, Republicans in the Senate have, in their minority, defended a president who's pretty convincingly charged with criminal violations from being impeached twice, stacked the Supreme Court. Democrats are looking at that and they're saying, okay, the other side is trying to sort of fix the game. We need to really counterbalance that.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, in preparing for this show, I came across this interesting observation by David Leonhard of the New York Times. He figured out that the average black voter has only 75% of the voting power in the Senate compared to the average white voter. Hispanic voters even fewer. So the idea of a new state, which would obviously be represented by Democrats, two senators and a voting member of the House, would help rectify that balance. That's sort of what you're getting at there, right?
I think that's what Democrats have come to.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, that's fascinating. That's really interesting. How has the current sort of moment, national reckoning around race, added fuel to this push for DC statehood?
Oh, well, I mean, that's certainly been a driver as well. If we remember back to this summer when the president used, federal authorities to move peaceable protesters out of Lafayette Park. For a photo op. And the mayor, of course, was completely powerless to do anything about this incursion of federal forces onto DC streets. I mean, you know, by the time those officers moved out of Lafayette Park onto the street, they're in the District of Columbia, and the mayor had no say in the matter. Mm. I think, you know, that really brought home to a lot of Americans who hadn't already been paying attention that, you know, there's something wrong here in the nation's capital. And you can add to that the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol as well, because D.C. police officers were brutally beaten by some of those rioters, and they were critical in helping the Capitol Police to defend the Congress.
Well, let's listen to D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser. Here she is speaking to reporters the day after that violent insurrection at the Capitol. She said if D.C. were a state and she were governor, she could have called out the National Guard to protect the Capitol.
When we become the 51st state, or before then, our congresswoman has a bill in the Congress right now to give the mayor control of the D.C. National Guard. We would not be restricted in any way from how to deploy the Guard, so we wouldn't have to clear a deployment plan with the Secretary of the Army.
So, Derek, stand by. I want to introduce Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton, who you mentioned. She's the non-voting delegate for the District of Columbia. And Congresswoman Holmes Norton, welcome to On Point. Thank you for joining us.
Glad to be with you.
It's really great to have you. You filed a D.C. statehood bill in every Congress since 1991. So on the one hand, I have to imagine that this has been a frustrating fight for you. But advocates are saying that, you know, as Derek was stressing, that there's a groundswell of public support for statehood right now. Do you agree with that?
I do agree. And it's important to recognize that the reason we haven't moved statehood until last June is because most of my time in the Congress I've been in the minority. The Democrats have not had the majority for most of the almost 30 years I've been in the Congress, so that has put statehood itself behind, since Republicans have not supported statehood. Now that we have the majority and we have a president and a vice president who both are for D.C. statehood, and Democrats control the House and the Senate, we have the trifecta that could move us close, much closer to D.C. statehood than ever before in our 220 years as a city.
What is the most important, compelling reason for D.C. statehood from your point of view?
Well, some of the reasons mentioned here have not been as compelling. For example, control of the D.C. National Guard. That does not require statehood. I have a bill pending, which I believe will pass this year, that will give the D.C. control of the National Guard under the so-called Home Rule Act. The Home Rule Act gives D.C. control over most of its business. What statehood would give us if we parcel out the most important ingredient, in fact, perhaps the ingredient, because in the Congress, I can speak on the House floor like anybody else. I'm now chairing a subcommittee. I have all of the powers of other members except that final vote on the House floor. So what do you get, Eleanor? What does D.C. get for statehood? It gets two senators, representation in the other body. When a bill passes the House that is important to D.C. statehood, I have to find allies in the Senate to get that bill passed, because we have no representation there. That senatorial representation would be the most important difference between our status now.
Congresswoman, I'm going to ask you to just hold that thought, because we're coming up against a break. There's a lot more to talk about. Listeners, we're talking about the debate over D.C.'s right to statehood, D.C.'s push for statehood. And coming up, we're going to hear some voices from those who oppose it, and more from Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton and historian Derek Musgrove. Derek, Congresswoman, stand by. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about the new push to make Washington, D.C. the 51st state. It's a long-running battle, but there's new energy now behind that push. At the moment, the city's 700,000 residents have one non-voting member of Congress. That's Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton, who we're talking to right now. But pro-statehood advocates say it's time to change that. I'm also joined by historian Derek Musgrove. And Congresswoman Holmes Norton, I want to just continue with you for a moment. You were talking about the importance of what statehood would mean. It would give you a vote in Congress. It would bring in two senators who would likely be Democrats. That's obviously one of the reasons why Republicans are so up in arms about this. But how do you make the case nationally? I understand, obviously, how this is of interest to you, to the folks in Washington, D.C., but how do you make folks from Maryland to California care about this issue?
You make people outside of the district care about it when they recognize that their own nation's capital does not have the same representation in Congress as they have. We know that because before last June, the first time we got this bill passed, most Americans were confused or simply ignorant about the status of their own to the polls. The polls showed people all over the place. Some of them thought we had the vote, I guess because they see me on the floor of the House speaking like anybody else. Some didn't know, and the scattering was pathetic. As soon as the D.C. statehood bill passed in June, another poll showed that more than 50% were for giving the district statehood. So the very drive for statehood has educated the public and helped us move the District of Columbia toward becoming the 51st state.
Can you give me back up a little bit and give me a little bit of history? Because, of course, we're talking, Congresswoman, about this moment where Democrats are in control of Congress. So it looks like a good moment for this issue. In 1993, there was an effort. Bill Clinton was president. Democrats controlled both houses of Congress. But the vote didn't, but it didn't work out. There was a vote against it. What happened in 1993?
Well, that's a very important point you raise. Yes, and I've just come to Congress. That was the 102nd Congress. We're in the 117th now. And in fact, I got a vote for statehood.
Mm-hmm.
The statehood did not pass, even though Democrats controlled the House of Representatives. The reason is that more than 50%, indeed I think 60% of the Democrats were Southern Democrats. No, I'm sorry, we got 60% of the Democrats.
Yeah, I'm looking at the numbers that I saw as 105 Democrats and all but one Republican voted against it. I'm not sure how that
That's
works
right.
out percentage-wise, but yeah.
Now, the reason is that we control the House because of Southern Democrats. And Southern Democrats were good on Democratic issues, but when it came to D.C. statehood, we lost them. That's why in my very first term in Congress, we were not able to get statehood, and since then, of course, we've been in the minority.
Derek Musgrove, as a historian, can you chime in a little bit about what happened there in 1993?
Yes, of course. I mean, the Congresswoman is absolutely correct. The Republican caucus was nearly unified. You had one Republican break ranks and vote for the 93 statehood bill. And they had really come to a consensus that they were going to oppose D.C. statehood as a party. And Democrats were roughly split. I think one of the biggest reasons, aside from the Southern composition of much of the caucus, was that leadership just didn't take the issue seriously. Bill Clinton's press secretary famously said, in Clinton in 93 was on record as supporting statehood. But when the vote was about to happen, his press secretary essentially says, yeah, the president's focused on other things, sort of signaling to the caucus that they could vote however they wanted. And House leadership literally told members to vote their conscience, which meant do whatever you want. And so there was no arm twisting. And Jesse Jackson, who was working with the congresswoman at the time, was positively livid and really blamed Democratic leadership for that loss.
Interesting. Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton and Derek Musgrove, I want to play just a few minutes with an interview that I did with with Congressman Dusty Johnson. As you know, he's come up with an idea. He calls it a compromise, which he described to me on Tuesday this way.
Well, my proposal would do what our country has done in the past, which is return portions of Washington, D.C. back to the state from whence it came. In 1849, we gave the residential parts of the D.C. on the Virginia side back to Virginia. That allowed those citizens to vote for Virginia United States senators. I think it's gone very well. And I want to do the same thing with the residential parts of D.C. on the Maryland side.
I see. So this would return all of the 700,000 residents of D.C. to Maryland, essentially.
Yes. In essence, the District of Columbia would be just shrunk down to the National Mall, the Capitol, the legitimate seats of our government. And that would give the D.C. residents an opportunity to vote for Maryland United States senators. And it would also give them a voting member of the United States House. Now, admittedly, this is, you know, purists on both sides are not going to like this. But I think that's how you know it has a potential to be a reasonable compromise.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't need to tell you that I don't think your bill is going to go over really well with the people in D.C. who have been advocating for their own state and have been doing so for a long time. What do you say to them?
Well, two things. Number one, the Constitution makes it very clear that D.C. is not a state. It's a special district. And I think unless you're going to amend the Constitution, which is highly unlikely, then I don't think statehood is a realistic option for them, which means my bill is better for those residents. Secondly, I would say that, you know, you need to have some bulk of either population or geography to really be a state. Now, D.C. is not a state. It's a city. In the last 200 years, when you look at every state that has been made a state in the last 200 years, it's got either 6 million residents or at least 10,000 square miles. And D.C. fails both of those tests by a long shot.
But let me ask you about that. And I know you've heard this, but I'm going to ask it anyway. So D.C. has more than 700,000 residents. That's a larger population than the states of Vermont, than Wyoming. So if the residents of those states enjoy the privileges of statehood, why not D.C.?
Well, I mean, that's not how we do things, right? I mean, D.C. may, you know, certainly they have some more population than some states, but they don't have the geography. You know, we don't say, hey, Cleveland, you hit 700,000 people. Now you get to be your own state. And Cleveland or Laredo or San Antonio or San Francisco, these communities all have their own culture. They all have their own pride, just like D.C. does. That doesn't mean we make them their very own state.
Let's just say D.C. was predominantly a Republican city. And if it became a state, Republicans would get two more senators and another member of Congress. Would you still be opposed to it?
Well, I just can't get around the fact that the Constitution says that D.C. is a special district and not a state. Those words are not Republican words. They're not Democrat words. They are black and white words written on the page. And I can't get around that.
Yeah. So that's the main thing, not the concern that it would mean three additional congressional seats for the Democrats.
No, I mean, that's not my concern. Right. I mean, if I was if I wanted to do everything I could to, you know, hold back suffrage from the residents of D.C., I certainly wouldn't be pushing this. I mean, this would give them, I mean, they right now have no voting representation in the House. This would give them full voting representation in the House.
How has your idea been received by Maryland Governor Larry Hogan? Have you run it by him?
I haven't. I mean, I think I know Governor Hogan a little bit. He and I share a passion for bridge building and compromise. So at some point, I will ask him what he thinks, and we'll see where we go from there.
So you're calling your proposal the District of Columbia Maryland Reunion Act. What kind of support are you getting? I mean, you suggested you're not expecting to get a lot of support from the folks in D.C. Who is behind this?
My proposal has gained a fair amount of momentum on the Republican side. I do think as long as people think that D.C. statehood is a possibility, it's going to be harder to gain a lot of momentum on the Democratic side. People in this era are not inclined to accept a half or two-thirds of a loaf.
All right. Well, Congressman Dusty Johnson, a Republican from South Dakota, thanks so much for your time. We're really grateful.
Anytime. Thanks much.
So we're back live with Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton and historian Derek Musgrove. Congresswoman, I imagine that you are not enamored of the congressman's proposal.
You know, you'll notice he's from South Dakota, not from Maryland. retrocession has been proposed before. And
retrocession is the idea that of giving essentially a chunk of the city back to Maryland, right?
That's precisely what it is.
Right.
Now, the problem with that, you notice that this member from South Dakota never mentioned until you asked him about where Maryland stands. Cindy Hoyer, the highest ranking Maryland representative, in fact, he's the highest, except for the speaker in the Congress, is a strong supporter of D.C. statehood. But he's never said that he supports retrocession. Let's see what retrocession would mean. Maryland now has one large city, Baltimore. If the District of Columbia became part of Maryland, the rest of Maryland would be drowned out by two large cities. Retrocession would require Maryland to desire, and you notice he said he hadn't asked Maryland to receive another city.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, every Maryland representative except the one Republican from Maryland supports D.C. statehood.
Right. So it doesn't sound like it's going to go very far if Maryland isn't in favor. Can you respond a little bit to this constitutional issue that he raises? And let me throw another voice at you. Our producer, Anna Bauman, talked to Roger Pilon from the Cato Institute. That's a conservative-leaning think tank focused on free market and limited government. And he gave three reasons that he doesn't believe Congress could make D.C. a state via statute. Here's what he said.
Congress has only enumerated powers, and you look through its powers and you see no power to create from the current District of Columbia a new state. Secondly, it's likely that you're going to need the consent of Maryland to do that, from which the current district was carved out in 1790. And finally, perhaps most importantly, you would have to repeal the 23rd Amendment, which provided for electors for the District of Columbia for the presidential election. You can't repeal a constitutional amendment by mere statute.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. So, Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton, can you respond a little bit to this, these
Absolutely.
Constitutional issues that are raised?
First of all, Maryland ceded the land to the district in perpetuity. So there's no giving the land back or mm-hmm. Maryland or getting the land back. And in terms of repealing the amendment which gave the district three electoral votes, it is true. You'd have to repeal that amendment. And I believe I am safe in saying when the district becomes the 51st state, the easiest constitutional amendment to pass will be the amendment to take back an extra three electoral votes because we would already have them with statehood.
Mm.
So, yes, it would have to be repealed, and I think it would be easily repealed. That is not an issue.
Derek Musgrove, I'd like to ask you about sort of how the backers of the D.C. statehood movement get around the big constitutional issue. And so my understanding is Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution explicitly provides for a national capital that would not be part of a state or treated as a state. How do they get around that?
Well, that's correct. But they specify in the Constitution, the founders did, that the capital should not exceed 10 miles square. They didn't say that the federal district couldn't be smaller than 10 miles square. In fact, it is today smaller than 10 miles square because of the retrocession of Arlington County to Virginia in 1846. So there's really not an obstacle there. The statehood bill calls for the reduction in size of the federal district down to the White House, the Capitol, the Mall, and a couple of federal buildings in that area. Mm. And the populated residential part of the District of Columbia would then become its own state. By the way, the gentleman who is advocating for retrocession essentially advocates the same thing as far as dividing up the land. The federal district would remain that area downtown, and then the populated area in his thinking would go back, would be retroceded to Maryland.
Yeah, it's interesting that they share that in common. That is, the advocates for statehood and the retrocession people share that idea in common of just making what remains as the capital much, much smaller.
And if I could add this, what I don't think they share in common yeah. is a respect for the democratic will of the people of the District of Columbia.
Mm.
I mean, advocates of statehood can say. In 2016, the residents of the District of Columbia voted in excess of 80% to adopt statehood as their favored method for gaining representation in the Congress. District residents have never, in any serious numbers, advocated for retrocession. If you look back to all the way to 1803, which is when the first retrocession bill was introduced in Congress, just 2 years after district residents lost their right to vote. All of those bills come from members of Congress who live elsewhere. Never has there been a retrocession movement among the residents of the District of Columbia.
All right. Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton, we literally have 10 seconds left before we get to the break. What is the next step as you see it? Very quickly before we have to say goodbye.
We're going to have another hearing on D.C. statehood and another vote. And the reason we're doing this is we find that these hearings and these votes move us towards statehood because they educate the Congress to what they simply did not know. When people find out that the more than 700,000 residents of their own capital don't have the same rights that they have, they get on board.
All right. Eleanor Holmes Norton, she's the congresswoman, the non-voting delegate for the District of Columbia. Thank you so much for joining us today. We're very grateful to hear from you.
My pleasure.
And Derek Musgrove, historian, stay with us. We're going to talk a little bit more about the future of D.C.'s push for statehood. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. Tomorrow on the program, Texas is the biggest energy-producing state in the U.S., but this week's frigid weather crashed the system. We'll talk about our vulnerable power grids tomorrow, and we want to hear from our friends in Texas. Are you without power? What are you doing to stay warm? Have you prepared? Were you prepared for a situation like this? Share your stories with us by leaving us a voicemail at 617-353-0683. Again, a call out to folks in Texas who are dealing with some really cold weather and some difficult conditions. Give us your story at 617-353-0683. This hour, I'm joined by historian Derek Musgrove, author of Chocolate City, A History of Race and Democracy in the Nation's Capital. And we're talking about the decades-long debate over whether Washington, D.C. should be granted statehood and about the new energy behind that push. Derek, stand by because I want to revisit a moment for a few minutes that reflects a bit of the character of Washington, D.C., this city that wants to be a state. So on January 6th, the day of the insurrection, as pro-Trump extremists headed toward the Capitol, they were met by D.C. resident Peter Tracy, who told them exactly what he thought of them. His neighbor, Shauntia Humphreys, responded from her car.
I know. They really destroying our city.
They're destroying the
That video of Peter and Shantia went viral, and it sparked a friendship between the two residents of D.C., upset about the violent assault on the Capitol that shook their city and the rest of the country. So here they are recalling that day, beginning with Shantia, describing what she saw as she drove past Peter's house.
And I seen Peter, but my window was rolled up, and I didn't hear what he was saying, but his arm movements and his facial expression, I really was interested, so I rolled the window down.
Treasonous pieces of
And I'd been watching on TV the joint session that was supposed to be counting, you know, the electoral votes, when all of a sudden the cameras shifted and, you know, there were these swarms of people coming into the Capitol. Once the people, not people, but I should say, you know, basically rioters or seditionists, you know, came by the house, you know, I just went out on the porch and let them have it.
Out of town!
You know, me coming home from work and seeing them just walking that through, you know, Massachusetts Avenue, waving the flags. Like, I've been wanting to say something about 20 blocks earlier, you know? But Peter just gave me the ammunition, and there it goes.
I know! They really destroying our city! They're destroying the city, and it's like nobody gives a They started Black Lives Matter. They got tanks rolling down Pennsylvania Avenue. But they let these crackers take over the goddamn Capitol.
That's true.
What the
f-
is that?
It makes me teary-eyed. It made me feel like, damn, I ain't understanding. Y'all don't. You know, why they don't understand equality?
Yeah, just when it was left for Black Lives Matter, we couldn't even do none of that, and we died.
I marched in June for the lives that was lost through police brutality. So I just feel like to see them invade the U.S. Capitol with no consequences at the time, it was just a destruction of peace. It was a slap in our face as Black people, you know.
The beauty of that video, I think, is that it shows that, you know, people can communicate with each other.
We come from two different backgrounds. I'm a Black young woman. He's, you know, a middle-aged.
You're very close.
We connected and we shared the same value in the video, you know.
And I hope in my lifetime I never see anything like that again. Because D.C. is a welcoming, diverse place. We have our problems. We have many problems, but we respect each other.
Yes, we invite everybody.
Exactly.
Everybody welcome. I'm telling you, you know.
Yeah.
I just want everybody just to take the time just to relax and listen. Understand people.
Be respectful.
Yes, I also want to thank you guys too for my 15 minutes of fame.
It's part of history, you know. You know, that's nice and that's gratifying, but I'm equally glad that I have a friend in Shantia. Clearly, I know that that's survived.
Oh, yeah.
You know, 15 minutes
of fame. Yeah, that's going to be years to come.
Yeah.
That was Peter Tracy and Shantia Humphreys. Journalist Veronica Westerman filmed their exchange and posted it on Twitter. And Derek Musgrove, our historian who's here with us, I wanted to play that back and forth between them just to remind listeners that D.C. isn't just the seat of the U.S. government. It's also a city of neighborhoods, of communities, of residents like Shantia and Peter. But we touched on this at the beginning of the hour, and I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit about how the events of January 6th sort of affected this whole discussion around statehood. And as we look at the Capitol now, surrounded by barbed wire and so forth, and metal fencing, how is all that playing into this debate?
Hmm. Well, I first off, it's you know, God bless both of the individuals in that segment. I think they really expressed some of the feelings that we DC residents had on January 6th, and in the language that we were probably using at home in front of our TVs or standing on the street.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, the struggle for self-determination in DC, if you're a DC resident, can sometimes wear you down, because, you know, after a while you think that it might be hopeless that you're actually going to get some type of say in the Congress. And so you just sort of, you pull back and you start to think of our state as natural. And then something like January 6th happens, it just hits you in the face. And there are events like this that have occurred throughout the city's history. And you at that moment, you know, sort of summon that righteous indignation that is, I think, totally legitimate for someone who is a citizen of the United States, but who has no say in the deliberations of its national legislature. And I think the "and" is critical here. And people within that legislature know it and oftentimes use you and your city as sort of a place where they can experiment with policies, or they can, you know, talk poorly about you with knowing that there's no sanction for them because, of course, their constituents are back home.
What are you referring to in particular there? I'm intrigued by what you just referred to.
So I'll give you a couple of examples.
Yeah.
Back when George H.W. Bush wanted to launch his war on drugs in 1989, you know, this is his first major policy initiative after he gets into office. And a staffer of his, you know, comes up with this great idea. Let's have someone buy crack cocaine in Lafayette Square across the street from the White House. Mm. And then you can hold it up on TV to talk about the scourge of drugs and how bad it is in the nation's capital. The problem, of course, is that nobody sold crack in Lafayette Square. That's crazy, right? And so he actually had the DEA lure a young man to Lafayette Square, sell them some crack, and then arrest him so that he could have a prop on TV. You know, the jury that had to hear that case just said, look, this guy may not be a good person, but you're just using him as a prop for TV. We're not going to convict him. And he got convicted on something else later on. And so you have instances like that that literally come up regularly. I mean, in the late 1990s, members of Congress who just didn't think needle exchanges were good shut down D.C.'s needle exchange program. And our AIDS rate exploded as every healthcare professional knew it would until Congress finally lifted the ban in the early 2000s. So they literally, in that instance, to score points for the people back home, killed people here in D.C.
Hmm.
And so you have that stuff happen on a regular basis, and it's infuriating.
Derek, I want to play a little tape. Kojo Namdi, is a longtime public radio host for D.C.'s NPR member station WAMU. D.C. statehood has been a topic on his call-in program, the Kojo Namdi Show, many times over the years. So this is what he told us about what he hears from D.C. residents who call to weigh in on the issue.
What I get most is outrage that the rest of the nation seems to think that either we don't exist or we're not important, that our lives, to coin a phrase, don't matter.
And here's a little more of what Kojo said, that a lot of his listeners see racism as the driving force behind opposition to statehood.
Many of my listeners also feel that there is a large residue of racism that the District of Columbia has for so long been predominantly African-American, that there is a strain of racism that objects to a state that is so urban, so black, and so democratic.
So, Derek Musgrove, that seems like it sort of acknowledges, makes reference to what you were talking about a moment ago.
Hmm. Well, I mean, Kojo is a treasure, a local treasure, and he's absolutely correct. If D.C. became a state, it would be by 10 percentage points the blackest state in the union. The current leader is Mississippi with 36%. And unlike Mississippi, D.C. would be composed of a population that generally agrees across the racial divide on policy issues, whereas in Mississippi, the white majority is quite antagonistic to the policy preferences of the black minority. And so it would be a very different state than Mississippi, even though the numbers would be similar. And, you know, I think that historically, Kojo is also right on point. The city for the first 70 years of its existence, race wasn't a big issue when it came to D.C. representation because Black people couldn't vote. In fact, slavery was legal in the city through 1862. In fact, it was a major slave trading center, one of the biggest slave exporting cities in the country. But once African-Americans got the vote, Congress essentially moves to not just strip them of the vote in the 1870s, but to strip the entire city of the vote. A congressman from Alabama said it was kind of like burning down the barn to get rid of the rats. You know, the easiest way you make sure that Black people don't have a vote in D.C. is just to strip everyone of the vote. And so in 1874, the city is stripped of the vote, and it quite literally has no votes for anything at all until the middle of the 20th century. And there are people during that 100-year period who are attempting to get suffrage in the district, but they are blocked every single time by segregationists in Congress who overtly say, I'm doing this because my constituents don't want Black people voting, don't want Black people getting access to the fruits of citizenship in the nation's capital. And it's only in the 60s and 70s that embargo on legislation that would allow D.C. residents to have a vote of some sort is broken.
I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point. So, Derek, really important to hear that history because you really understand that what we're witnessing today is part of a long, continuous struggle, essentially, that is still ongoing. I want to get some of the pushback voices out onto the program. So here we are at a press conference last July. Senator Steve Daines of Montana, a Republican, said supporters of statehood for the capital city are out of touch with the rest of the country. Here's what he said.
And sometimes I think it's important for senators and congressmen, in fact, most of the time, get out of this city, go out to where the real people are at across our country and ask them what they think. They see this as a power grab, and they see this as Pelosi in D.C. at its worst. Lastly, it's unconstitutional.
And at a press conference in D.C. last summer, South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham said the Democrats are not pushing statehood for the sake of the city's residents, but as a power play in Congress.
It's not about the city. It's not about the people in the city. It's about a power grab. There's nothing these people won't do to change the face of the country. And we're tired of it. We're going to fight back. We fought back with Kavanaugh. We're going to make sure that Nancy Pelosi and all those who are driving her do not win the day. If a Republican had tried to do this in like circumstances, you'd be all over us.
So, Tarek Musgrove, when I listen to those two cuts, I mean, we've got Steve Daines talking about getting out of D.C. to where real people are at across the country. And you've got Lindsey Graham talking about Democrats wanting to change the face of the country.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Talk about dog whistles.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. So one thing I'll say is that they're consistent. These are not new arguments. These arguments are actually created by people like Pat Buchanan, the paleo conservative, people like Phyllis Schlafly, the famous opponent of the ERA, in the late 1970s, in response to a push at that time to pass a D.C. voting rights amendment, which would have amended the Constitution so that it treated D.C. as though it were a state for purposes of representation in Congress. And they come up with these ideas really because they can't argue the basic point, which is that it's not okay to deny American citizens, at that point about 800,000, today about 720,000, access to the levers of government. And so what they do is they play on people's political concerns. And so Phyllis Schlafly had this great line where she used to say, this is a power grab by Washington bureaucrats. What she didn't point out, and of course, Lindsey Graham repeats that, what she didn't point out is that the majority of federal government workers, lobbyists and lawyers who work downtown, live in Maryland and Virginia, a majority of them. Hmm. And so when you're talking about D.C. residents, the people who would be empowered if D.C. became a state, you're talking about school teachers, firefighters, small business owners, regular old people like the ones that they claim that they represent but don't live here.
Well, George Derek Musgrove, he's a history professor at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and author of Chocolate City, A History of Race and Democracy in the Nation's Capital. Derek, thanks so much for joining us and for adding the sort of long sweep of history to this moment that we're going through right now around the possibility of statehood for Washington, D.C. Really grateful. Really great to talk to you.
Anthony, thanks so much for having me.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation. You can get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. This hour was produced by Anna Bauman. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can Profit Motive Save the Planet is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.